and welcome to Hello and welcome to We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. I'm your host Spencer, and with me is I had a weird intro this time. Joel, this is us.
It's become much more difficult to come up with weird intros because our the movies we're watching are usually a bit more grounded in reality. This one does, or at least what the one I've seen is. Dwells into fantasy, but hey, it's me, Joel.
Yeah, so we have a special guest. He's a director, actor, writer. He does shows some podcasts and stuff. He has directed, I believe, two short films.
Yeah, two. Well, two that are out there.
Two. I saw the most recent one. We can talk about that in a little bit, but it's Entombed Gaunt.
How y'all doing?
Good. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, man. It's an honor.
Yeah. When I asked you to be on this special episode on how do you say his name? Because I've always said Jabril.
It's Jabril Diop. The only one that I sometimes get confused with is the last name. Is it Mambete or Mambeti? I can't remember. Sometimes.
I don't say Mambete, so I don't know. But yeah, special episode on him. We're talking about his only two feature films, Hyenas and Tuki Buki. And before we start, I'd like to ask you, what's your track record with Mambete?
I his name was a name that I had heard for a long time amongst many people. As like a filmmaker I should see, and then I saw Claire Denis mention him, mention Tuki Buki in a interview about Beau Travers, and I was like, oh, this is this guy I've heard about all these years. I need to like check him out. And I was finally able to, I actually saw Hyenas first. I got a copy of it and I watched it. And I was floored by it, and then I watched Tuki Buki as well after. So yeah, that's kind of how I discovered him. But it's been like a little over a decade ago that I saw Hyenas for the first time. Probably by just about a decade, actually.
Yeah. For me, when I first got into African history, like four years ago ish. I kind of turned that into like, oh, I wonder what African films are out there. And then I've learned about Tuki Buki and it's on Criterion. And at the time, Hulu was hosted Criterion movies. Mm-hmm. And I turned on Tuki Buki and I was horrified. And I did not try to watch it again for about a year. Because that intro.
Why were you horrified?
That would be my question.
I don't know what you could possibly find horrifying about Tuki Buki.
Well, it opens with a slaughterhouse footage, and being unprepared for that, it was a little like, oh, holy shit, I wasn't ready for this right now.
Okay, I can understand that, because actually, when I rewatched Tuki Buki yesterday, I totally forgot about the whole cow slaughtering.
Yeah, it's... but once I got through... I tried watching that, and then on Pandora, when I used to subscribe to it, I watched Hyenas. Not Hyenas. I watched The Little Girl Who Sold the Sun, the final Mbete film that came out the year after he died, which I fell in love with. And I kind of went backwards, so I got to Tuki Buki last, because it's like, well, I gotta finish out everything. And I got through it, and like I just fell in love with him as a filmmaker. So, Joel, besides me talking about these movies, did you even know about like Hyenas and all these things?
No, absolutely not. No, I didn't know anything other than the things that you mentioned when it came to this filmmaker. And that's, it's sorely untalked about, like African cinema. Seems to be in general, this is a perfect example of that situation. I mean, I'm a film nerd, but I didn't go to the classes or anything like that. I just picked up the stuff on my own. So, I wonder in a world cinema class if this would have been covered or anything like that. I have no idea.
You know, my bet is he seems to get some traction. Like, I know, who's the guy who did that Story of Film and Odyssey piece? He talked about Mbete quite a lot. Mm. So he seems to get some traction as a very important filmmaker. And probably a little easier because he has so few films to keep track of them.
And I have the Blu-ray a set of the Scorsese World Cinema. And on the Tukibuki disc, there's an interview with the guy who directed Timbuktu.
Okay.
What is his name? I forgot his name, but
I assume it's Tim.
Yes, it's Tim. But Timbuktu, I think it's one of the few African movies to ever win an Oscar for Best Foreign Film.
Yes, it's Sissoko. I can't say his first name.
Oh, Jesus, I'm not going to try. But Sissoko, and he just kind of waxed the poetic about how to him Mbete is a incredible filmmaker, which I agree with, and he said, like, that's his, like, the best director in his opinion, which I wouldn't go that far, but then again, I'm not an Oscar-winning director, so who knows?
Yeah, some people, would attach to whatever. I mean, that's the thing about that. Like, best director is such a subjective thing to say about somebody. Like, even the people that people think as like the masterclass things, like the Hitchcocks and all those other things like that, not everybody thinks these guys are that great. Like, this gentleman with his two movies, you know, goes into that small category of people who didn't have a stinker among their, their library. And that is because he made a couple more short films besides these things, right? Yeah. And then he died before he could do his third film in this series that he had imagined.
Yeah, that's what I read.
Yeah, the last two films were associated trilogy because Tukibuki and Hyenas are loosely related, not loosely, but thematically they're very strongly related, but like story wise it's kind of loose, but they really work it. They work together well and overlap well. But then after that, he did these, I guess they're short films, are 45 minutes long. So,
still considered.
Okay. But he's supposed to do three of them, Trilogy of Ordinary People, where he focused on just like the poor people living in Dakar, Senegal, and these very simple, like silent film style short films, and he died after the second one. And the third one, depending on what interview you read, he gives different answers as to what the third one was going to be. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really sure what was going to be next. But it's just kind of tragic he had to die so soon.
Yeah.
I'm really surprised that you like Tukibuki, Spencer.
Why?
Because you hate the French New Wave.
I think French New Wave is okay.
You hate it? Hate it? Hate
okay.
it.
I don't know.
I saw you tearing up a beret and throwing a baguette at a poor woman who was just walking by. You were so angry about it.
I mean, I like Breathless, I like, but I didn't fall in love with it. And Alphaville was kind of a struggle for me to get through. And what's the other one?
All three of the French New Wave.
I've only seen Godard, and one Melville, which I kind of like very much either.
That's the problem, man. You only watch a Godard. I mean,
yeah. I didn't know. I just kind of was going randomly like, oh, I've heard this movie's good.
I feel like 5 years ago. Godard is like probably the most polarizing of them all. Like, I feel like you either really like him or you don't.
He reminds me of why when people talk about Ridley Scott's movies, like Ridley Scott did like two or three like movies that are like, wow, that's crazy that he did that. And he did a whole bunch of mediocre garbage. Yeah. And it's like Godard, it's like you've done these three great, you know, genre defining French New Wave films, and like, oh, you also did a whole bunch of stuff that I don't care about.
Yeah, I mean, his period, his period is definitely a decade, you know, or
yeah,
you know, after that decade, and I quite like that, you know, the 60s Godard stuff, but after that, I'm kind of like, you know, I could take it or leave it.
Yeah.
But before we get to, Tookie Bookie, I watched your last short film, Whiteface.
Oh, cool.
And I was honestly kind of blown away. I found it deeply affecting, and I watched it almost a week ago, and I'm still thinking about it a whole lot. Like, it took me almost to the end to realize, like, you were wearing, like, a minstrel suit, just, like, a white version of it.
Yeah.
And, it just really cut deep, and maybe it's, I don't know, like, you're probably heard this before, but, like, it's, like, it really is great.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you, for real.
Oh, you're welcome.
He didn't offer to show it to me.
You can go on Vimeo and watch it.
Oh.
You can rent it or buy it.
You mean, like, on the internet?
Yes.
Yeah, it's available on the nets for stream and purchase, which is around the same price, you know.
And DeWanda Wise was a producer on it.
She was. Yes, she was. Her and her husband, Alano Miller, who was on Underground.
Let's see. All right, so Joel, do you want to get Tookie Boogie over with?
Get it over with?
Yeah.
I mean, we could talk about it, yeah. I mean, yeah, the good thing about this, I don't know about Hyenas, but this one is not really a plot-driven movie.
Nah, not really.
I mean, I would describe it. It's about a kid who is, and him and his girlfriend are kind of dreaming about living in Paris. They want to escape the life, I guess. But it's the movie's not really about that. I mean, because it's all this dream imagery and really cool editing and you know, also disturbing stuff like that. Like, yeah, Scarred for Life by the cow, and not just the cow,
the goat,
but the goat.
Yeah,
yeah, it's pretty scarring.
Which Spencer did not warn me about.
I forgot the goat.
I mean. He did. He mentioned the cow briefly. He didn't mention that. I've seen animals killed on film before. This was an animal who they cut the throat of, and then they kept on a cutting, and we kept on a. We watched it suffer, and I like you know I'm a pink skinned baby white westerner, so
yeah.
It's on me. That's what I'm saying. Okay. I realize
no, it's a lot. It's a lot for the uninitiated. I had forgot that was in the film, and I was like, oh, that's right. This happens.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not trying to go on a tangent, but it reminds me kind of The Beast, the Brochek, where it has a very striking opening involving animals, but the beast is horses. Fucking, and it's intense. You see a lot of horse cock.
You're always trying to tell me to watch these movies where animals are doing it. And, you know, I just no. I'm just
you should watch The Beast. It's an experience.
All right. So what is the Maury? Right is the name of the guy. He's constantly getting ragged on by like you know his relatives and people in the area that he lives, and then. There's just like in the beginning, there's that group of ruffians who like catches him on his scooter on the college campus, and like, what is going on with that? They like have him tied to the back.
Yeah, they're like the young, I guess, like revolutionaries, like communists or whatever.
Yeah, it's kind of like I didn't know, and that part just kind of goes away. Like, we don't get a conclusion to if he got off the truck or not, but we do see him later back on his motorbike, which has a steer skull attached to the front of it.
Yeah, and I noticed watching these movies back to back that they open and close on the same image of like Tookie Bookie opens with a herd of cattle, I think Zebu, I can't remember the exact species, and it closes on the zebu, and Hyenas opens with a herd of elephant, and elephant, and then it closes with a herd of elephants.
Yeah. So they're driving around. They're talking about how they want to move to Paris, and they're gonna. Basically, they don't really have a way, so they decide they're gonna try to steal their way into it. So at first, he tries to take money from somebody who's doing a card game, which is funny.
Yeah, that's
everyone is pissed.
Yeah, and that leads to I think it kind of blends together a little bit because it's not too driven, but
right.
Who is it? I think it's Charlie, who is kind of like a cartoonish gay character.
Oh, yeah.
Stereotypical gay guy, which, I'm sorry, like, I know it might be offensive, but it was making me laugh how he was just like, oh, Maury, why don't you come into the shower? It's so warm, and I'll clean your back for you. And he just wouldn't stop.
Oh, and he just keeps going the whole time. It's like, dude, you realize you've been in the shower for about 25 minutes, and the dude is like, he's not coming in.
He says, like, I'll scratch your back, you scratch my back. Like,
oh, you know, see what happens, see if it...
it is offensive, but it is genuinely really funny.
Yeah, it is. And Maury steals a bunch of his clothes, and steals a bunch of his money, and then he ends up even stealing his car and his driver.
Yeah. Oh, man.
And I can't remember when that happens. There's a weird scene where the girl is on the motorbike by herself, and she like sees a white guy right in a tree.
The Tarzan guy. I love that guy.
Yeah.
Well, not really.
The big old poof afro.
Yeah, a wild boy
talking to the birds.
Yeah.
And she ends up crashing the motorcycle, so they lose it temporarily. But we see them driving around. There was a part earlier where is that woman is supposed to be his aunt?
The woman who killed the goat.
Yeah, the woman who was harvesting.
That organs. Is her her aunt.
Oh, her auntie.
Yes, that's played by Amina Tafal, and she's in 3 or 4 of Mbete's films.
Yeah,
and she I believe was a poet and singer.
That's what it's, if you click on her name on the Wikipedia article in Tuki Buki, it takes you to the French Wikipedia, so I'm not exactly sure what it says. It does say, jazz singer, national theater, stuff like that, and then a lot, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different, movies are mentioned. So, yeah, that, her character... The way her character goes from, at first it seems like she's friendly with him, and then when he doesn't do what she wants him to do, he's like, oh, you're cursed, I'm gonna, ruin your life, you're useless, and all this, just yelling at him as he's driving away. She doesn't care, she's gonna keep yelling. And then, after they get the car, there is a parade that they kind of mix in with, and we see a lot of...
Yeah, with the parade sequence... The first time I watched it, I thought that was fantasy, but I'm still not sure if that is real or not. Like, am I stupid for not being able to tell?
No, I when I watched it again on Saturday, I wondered again too. I was kind of like, is this a fantasy sequence? But then I kind of took it as a kind of representation, kind of like I'm sure you both have seen Chameleon Street, right?
No, I have the file. But
yeah, you definitely should watch in Chameleon Street. There's this whole kind of thing where Wendell or where the lead character Douglas Street talks about how when he would put on certain type of clothing, everyone would accept him as having had made it. And I kind of watched it this time where it was like, oh, suddenly you are in this clothing. Well, that means you must have made it. Oh, you're going to Paris. Yes, of course you've made it. So I was kind of like, it was kind of interesting to me. When I first saw it, I thought it was a dream sequence. But this time I kind of took it a little bit differently. I was like, you know what, this seems like some kind of representation of status via these empty kind of things that don't really mean anything.
Yeah. It made me think of The Spook Who Sat by a Door, which I just watched yesterday. And that has a sequence of Dan Freeman being like, well, if you dress up like a janitor and smile, you're invisible.
Right.
And
you
can... it's a great sequence.
Which is exactly in real life the same.
Oh, yeah. The spook of Sapphire Door is still insanely relevant, which is kind of terrifying.
Oh, it is.
Which will be a future episode.
The spy we needed.
Yeah.
My take on that is that they may have been a part of it, but you know, it wasn't a parade for them. I think it was just they got like on a parade was already happening, like a military parade, and they just like kind of merged in with them, and people didn't, you know, the audience didn't know. It was just, you know, here's a couple of well dressed people in a nice car waving. They must. Yep, let's cheer for them too.
Yeah, and the car is but decked then, out in like red, white, and blue, and it's just a very clear symbol of like foreign decadence. Aside from their, like their French, yep. Like shadow of the colonialism, which still definitely lingers over Senegal.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, it's like okay, good Joel. Man, acknowledge that and just move on because you don't have any historical context. Anyway, that was me insulting myself. Then they actually pull up outside of where her auntie lives, and she sings an impromptu song about, oh, they've returned and they're so rich and wonderful. I think he even gives her some of the money that they got.
Yeah, I thought that was a fantasy, but
yeah, I'm not.
But sure. Like it slips in and out of fantasy, just like I remember reading. I forgot what site it was. But, like, one of the last interviews he did, and, like, Boonwell comes up, and how like, he kind of slips into fantasy, like, Boonwell, well, and, like, the Milky Way, which I brought before, because that movie's brilliant. Like, it'll just kind of go from, like, oh, this is real, until, like, oh, now they're traveling through time. Like, it has right. That kind of feel to it.
Yeah, like in the discreet charm of the bourgeoisie, that suddenly they're on stage, and then they're off, or something like that, yeah. I could see that.
I can't remember if I've seen that one.
Oh, I love that might be my favorite Boonwell film, Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie. No. I love that.
Yeah, that's the last late Boonwell I haven't seen. I've seen, I think, everything from Simon in the Desert to Phantom Liberty, except for Discreet Charm.
Yeah, I think that is I get that mixed up with Exterminating Angel.
Yeah.
But I think I've seen Discreet Charm. Anyways, we're not doing the Boonwell cast.
Spencer, I know. I'm sorry. leave it to the Pink Smoke guys. They can do a much better job than us.
Mm-hmm. So they take some of their money and they buy some passes, some illegal passes to get on a boat that's going to take them to Paris. So they're on the boat and Maury suddenly decides. I guess he decides he doesn't want to. He can't do it. So he runs off. And we see some shots of that white guy we were talking about earlier that was living in the tree riding on Maury's motorbike. And it's cutting between Maury running to try to find this and the kid on the bike. And also the police are looking for them because the guy they stole from did report.
Yeah. And he started flirting.
Report to a guy he was going to have a special dinner with
it
later.
It was Inspector... What was it? Mbete.
Yeah, it's his name, which is kind of fun. I found that kind of funny, actually.
And I think he calls Mr. Diop, too, at some point, too.
Yeah, there's a Diop. He seems to always be in his films. I mean, we'll talk about Hyenas later, how he actually is physically in his film also. Yeah. But, you know, he tries to make his presence felt in different ways.
Yeah, like, he's this, like, comparing this to, like, Black Girl, which I see people compare these two a lot, like, it's the more fantastical, like, take on the same, themes.
Yeah, totally.
Where Black Girl's, like, dealing with the post-colonial life and dealing with, like, now they have to be an independent country and all that. And then this one is like, okay, what if it was funny and, like, more dreamy?
Yeah.
Which, like, as horrifying as Tookie Boogie can get, I find it easier to watch than Black Girl, which is this.
Well, that's a downer.
Yeah, it's just so upsetting.
It's an upsetting flick. But
they have a big difference in the endings.
Yeah. And I think that's Black Girl's aim. I think Black Girl is really aiming to hit you in the gut about this woman's experience, but also the African's experience with the West.
Yeah, and,
absolutely.
And there's that scene towards the end of Dookie Bookie where you get the French people on the boat commenting, oh, yeah. And like they're like, I wrote down one line. Oh, that's like African art is a joke, and just trashing the whole thing. It's being like kind of shitty white people, and it's very not subtle, but I think that's clearly a point of like, mm-hmm. Even though they're free nation, that doesn't mean that everything is like is great. There's still that built-in racism from being a colony for probably over 100 years, because France was historically very brutal when they would take over, where the British would kind of take over financially at first, and then militarily. The French would just go on military first and, like, get ready to fight or surrender.
And they show that contrast of, like, these people living in this poor village, you know, where they're buying their vegetables from the vendor who, you know, she's barely got any, and the people who buy it can't actually afford it, so they're, you know, like, put it on my tab or whatever, right next to these big cities that they aren't occupying.
And, like, that also, the whole slaughterhouse footage is like, if you live out here, you're kind of, you work with cattle or you sell vegetables, and, like, and there's a city, and, like, it's just this very stark, graphic way to show poverty.
And who knows who that food, you know, slaughtering the cattle is even for?
Well, I'm pretty sure it wasn't like an Italian sleazy movie where, like, they just kill animals just to kill it. I'm pretty sure they...
No, I mean, like, they weren't probably not slaughtering the animal for themselves. They were probably slaughtering it for somebody who had, you know, buying the meat so they could resell it or something like that.
Right, or the tourists and the visitors would get, that's like, that's prime meat.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, that was a horrifying scene. That didn't stop me from going McDonald's later in the day. So, you know, I'm a hypocrite.
Same.
So the end of the movie is Maury finally does catch up with his bike, but he catches up at it to find it on the street where it looks like the white kid has killed himself or has killed, although he does say something when the ambulance is taking it away. But the skull that has been prominently displayed has cracked in half, and you know, there's just so much you can read into so many of these scenes, and that's part of the reason why what makes the movie so remarkable, so good.
Will you ever watch it again?
Yeah, I definitely would. I mean, now that I'm prepared for the thing, you know, that part is not a necessary part for the movie. I wouldn't have to do that. Like, I'm glad I saw it once, even though, like I said, it's scarring.
Yeah, a little bit.
But I appreciate new experiences in film. So I probably would, like, if I were going to recommend it to somebody, I would probably tell them straight out, like, there's a pretty horrifying part in the beginning, and then a little later on you get kind of a redux with another animal, but the movie is worth the sit through.
Yeah, it's a very, I don't know, like, I've only seen it, like, twice, but it's still, like, this is kind of haunting, and like this lingers with me still, because it's like the, like, Mbete's use of montage is this very, it's beautiful the way he is. We'll just have like a montage. It's like this instead of like a personal story, because after seeing his four films, I kind of get the feeling he wasn't too interested in dialogue necessarily.
No.
Except for Hyenas, which was an adaptation of a Swiss play, but the other stuff is like definitely like he could make a silent movie if he wanted to.
Yeah, it's interesting. I found like the in Dookie Bookie when I watched this time, these like he's very like low angle shots, and it always felt like, you know, they were being pulled to the ground almost, because he kind of kept going from the low angle a lot of the time, or a slow, like, lower tilt. And, you know, but then it would always have this kind of background with, like, the sky, you know. So, like, you know, it's interesting. He created so poetically in that film that you're able to really experience and feel, you know. That's why you accept, I think, kind of the loose narrative, because you're experiencing so much with the visuals and the, and it's the overall tone that he's creating.
Yeah. Oh, I have my notes. The animal slaughter reminds me of the Transfiguration, that horror movie from, at this point, 3 years ago, about the, it's like Martin, the Romero movie, but if it were set in the ghetto with, like, a weird kid. Oh, it's really depressing, but it's a great little character psychological horror movie. And, like, the weird kid likes to watch slaughterhouse footage, and he thinks it's a vampire, and it's like Martin.
That kid's got problems.
Yeah, it's like, if you've seen Martin, the Romero movie, it's like that, but a bit a weird, another twist on it. And Lloyd Kaufman is in it as a homeless man he kills. So if you get to see that.
Lloyd Kaufman as himself.
I wish. No, I don't. I'm sure he's a nice man.
Wait, you want him dead? No. Oh my God.
I don't like his movies, but I'm sure he's a nice guy.
Yeah, he's a nice guy.
The footage at the end of the ship is used in, I'm not sure if you guys know about Ghost McGrady. He's, I guess, like a DJ producer, and he will remix, like, usually hip-hop and R&B songs, and he has kind of these weird videos on YouTube that are just visual collages of random clips that are kind of strung together, and he uses the end footage of Tuki Buki in one video for the Daybreak EP.
Oh, wow, I didn't know that.
And it took me, because when I got to end, I was like, I saw this recently. I don't remember where. And then I kind of realized, oh, Ghost McGrady totally used this footage and just mirrored it so he could, so he won't get sued. But it's on YouTube, and I'll link to it in the notes. But
yeah, Jay-Z and Beyonce also totally stole it too.
Yeah, I wonder if I've seen that. But I wonder, have they seen the movie?
I doubt it. No, you know, it's funny. It's. I was talking with this about when she used Julie Dash's stuff, and someone that I know that they said they're pretty sure the only reason why she ever watched Daughters of the Dust is because she had been constantly been told that, oh, you took this from Daughters of the Dust, and she's like, oh, wait a minute, I need to actually watch this so I could, like, you know, let people know. That it's being used, because, you know, it was she was working with Arthur Jaffa, and these people, like, people who work with Arthur Jaffa. So
wait, Beyonce was?
Well, yeah, there's, like, this whole collective of people who were you know, who work in creating her visual style, and I'm pretty sure Arthur Jaffa has worked with that team, and people who they come out of his wheelhouse and all that. So, you know, they're just using their aesthetic, and, you know, she's like, oh, that's cool, I like that. And then people, you know, then when she gets interviewed, they're like, so you're into Julie Dash? And she's like, yeah, totally. Someone give me Julie Dash videos, please. But I doubt they've seen Tuki Buki, or at least when it was presented to them, it wasn't their idea. Say, hey, let's use Tuki Buki. You know, someone in their visual team had seen Tuki Buki, and they were like, hey, you like this? And they're like, yeah, sure, this is cool.
Because seeing the image of them, it's like, if they see a movie, that she's going to leave him, and that's just kind of they seem to be in love. So it's like, I don't know, this is a weird weird reference to pull. It looks cool, but...
I didn't even think about that part, actually. But it's also a weird film to kind of... When you think about the politics of, like, something like Tuki Buki, where it's really, like, talking about westernization and, you know, should we be making that push as people? And then, you know, people like Beyonce and Jay-Z are just so... ingrained in being a part of, you know, Western capital culture, you know.
Yeah.
And it's kind of hilarious that they would use that image, but also par for the course of, you know, modern consumer culture where you could recontextualize everything.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I don't think they could identify with Maury or
hell no.
Or the Anta at this point in their life. Yeah. Maybe 20.
I'm about to say, if they had the dilemma, they were very young and they don't remember it.
But like this, the whole movie, as horrific as it can be, and as like the ending is kind of a downer, but not too much of a downer. Like it's just kind of sad when you see like, oh, there's kind of nothing for young people, and they just want to escape, and that still happens in Africa now, where it's a problem of people, mostly young people, trying to escape to Europe by sneaking on the ships or taking like illegal ships from. I think it's usually like Tunisia or Algeria, and it's usually like human traffickers who run these scams, and a lot of people end up dead. So like this, so this movie is still very relevant to what it's like to be young and living in certain African countries and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting because even when I watched, I thought about this in general. When you feel left out of something, and you begin to see your culture as inadequate because of all the things you don't have, and that's why, like, you know, I think it's Maury, right? Maury's, you know, change is so powerful because he begins to be like, wait a minute, no. There's something wrong with this. There's something not right with this, like, devaluing of self and wanting to go off to, you know, gay Paris to be, you know, something special.
Yeah, and in real life, he, I don't know if he was a herder before, but he was, like, a herdsman and, like, worked in, like, slaughterhouse and stuff. And
oh, wow.
That's what he kind of did for the rest of his life. I think he might be still alive. And and Anta, the actress, I didn't write down her name,
Is that his wife? Ooh. Yeah, I'm just wondering because they have the same last name.
Oh, no, she moved to Alaska at some point.
Wow.
Yeah, so like she really...
Well, that's a way.
Yeah, so like they really reflect their characters. Like I'm pretty sure she's still alive too, but you know, she actually got to escape and... live a life outside of Senegal, and he was like, nah, I want to stay instead. And a little detail I didn't notice the first time was that Charlie, the gay character, he speaks French, and everyone else, I think every other character you see except for the French white people, speak Wolof.
Yeah.
And that's just a little detail of, like, I've seen more African movies at this point. It's like, oh, okay, that's a very subtle class difference.
Yeah, it's weird because I only noticed that when he started speaking French, only because I can recognize French pretty easily. And I was like, wait a minute. Oh, that's right. They're speaking something. Okay, wow. And then it became clear to me. I was like, oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah, and it reminded me of the scene and... you say it, Zala?
Zala, yeah.
Where it's towards the end, where the main character, and then the board meeting with the cabinet members, and he's speaking Wolof, and they're like, "You don't have to speak Wolof when we do government business."
I love that film.
It's so great, funny. Film. I hope that comes back on Criterion Channel. I want to do an episode on it. But,
It was on Netflix streaming once, and then they took it down. Huh. It has such a weird life online.
Yeah, every time I look for it on eBay or whatever, I always get the novel, and I'm always tempted to get the novel, but I'm not sure if it's in English. Because how do you say his name? I'm not sure how you say his name.
I believe it's Semben, but I can't. I'm gonna remember. I'm gonna forget. Also, that's terrible. Should look these up.
Because he wrote a bunch of novels too.
Yeah.
And who was it? Mbete was I think he was a poet too, because there was long gap between Tokubuki and his next film. I think it was like 16 or 17 years.
That was a long time.
And because he did a short film in 89, I think.
Yeah, which I've never seen.
And his stuff before Tokubuki, I've looked for years, and I have no clue how to get hold of it.
I think it's almost impossible. Someone I knew had a copy of was it Badu Boy? But yeah. I haven't been able to locate them either. I think they're almost impossible to get. You probably get them in Europe somewhere.
Yeah, and his brother's still alive, Wasis Duop, who does soundtracks for my favorite living director, Mohamed Salah Haroun. I think every movie Haroun makes has a Wasis soundtrack to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it might be a weird rights issue, but and his niece, Mbete's niece, is directing a movie that is premiering at Cannes this year. So the family's still active, so I just wonder if it might be a weird rights thing.
And she's one of Claire Denis's, like, you know, main actresses. She was in, like, Nanette and Bonnie. And also, I believe she's in 35 Shots of Rum, right? She's the lead woman in 35 Shots of Rum. I'm almost positive, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, I shamefully still haven't seen any Claire Denis. I have White Material on Netflix DVD in the next room over, and it's been there for a week.
Well, you know, speaking of these films, it'd be very interesting for you to watch, like, Beautrevet, White Material. Mm-hmm. I think Beautrevet more than anything because... you see the Mbete influence. I mean, she said Tokubuki because she grew up, you know, in Africa, mm-hmm. a significant part of her young life, that Tokubuki had a big influence on her. And you see a lot of the imprint of Tokubuki in Beautrevet. Like it's embedded in there, and the kind of the poetics of the visual language and the shot language, it's like it's very much him.
Hmm.
And she's not quite. She's very honest about it. She's very open about it.
Oh, so she's not a Tarantino.
Oh no! She's definitely not him. she is clear, concise, and like yes, you know. There's two interviews I saw where she talked about it, one that I read and one that I saw. The White Tarzan guy. You know, it's weird. I don't know if this is like my kind of present day read. But I thought of all of these, like, you know, white guys who want to come to places like Africa or, you know, Asia to have these kind of wild experiences. I found this great juxtaposition of this, like, person who was clearly not from there wanting to be all up in it and be dangerous, you know, in this wild frontier while they were trying to, like, go to Europe. These two black people trying to go to Europe and he's trying to be here. But then remember when he gets hit on the beat he falls off the bike and he's like, is that it was a magnificent beast, and he had this kind of reverence, and it makes me think of this, you know, this whole idea of, you know, white men not having virility, and they go to places like Africa or go amongst poor people to kind of find their virility, you know. So, you know, he wanted to, and he saw the, you know, his energy within this bike. That's kind of what I, at least what I got from it this time. Probably the first time when I saw it too, but I'm not sure actually.
I mean, that would basically be my read too.
Yeah,
is that like this is a representation of somebody who is gone to this place because he thought it was going to be a certain way, and so he's acting like a stereotypical Tarzan in a tree kind of way, wild person getting back in touch with nature kind of thing.
It's like,
that's not the way the people act over there. Oh, he doesn't know. He's living in a tree with birds.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, that clears things up. Because like, that was like one of the few things that was really kind of bothering me trying to figure out. But
it could just be a silly moment. But
I mean, it is funny and silly.
too. Well, I think he definitely is taking a piss, you know. But knowing my Betty, you know, I think he's definitely like, oh, I need to talk about this real quick.
Yeah.
Y'all need to know how I feel about this.
And he had, Mbete had no paper script. He kind of liked to work on instinct. And and he movie was made for $30,000, I guess, dollars, American dollars. Scorsese doesn't clarify if it's like francs or dollars. But he does say dollars, so.
Get him on the phone.
Yeah, I'm sure he's not busy.
Marty.
All right, so Joel, final thoughts on Tuki Puki?
Why did you scar me with animal violence? No, what kind of final thoughts? I really want to hear about hyenas, man. I don't know what to say here.
All right, but I need to point out. Well, whenever I tell people about this or mention it on Twitter or whatever, I will usually bring up the animal violence because I don't want to shock someone and scare them away from this, like how I was scared away from it the first time I saw it.
I am incredibly sensitive to that stuff. Like, I think I would have less of a effect on me if I were to see a person get slaughtered instead of an animal. That's how much I like animals. I think most people are, though.
I think that's a hard thing to see. Like, people don't really watch their food get butchered. You know, like, I think we live in a place where you go to the supermarket and you see it cut. You don't watch the process.
I mean, my dad grew up in a small town in West Virginia, and there was a pig slaughterhouse near his house. And when he was a kid, he and his five brothers would go and just watch the pigs get slaughtered because there's nothing to do in the town.
Wow.
So, like, my dad and his family are kind of numb to stuff like this. Like, he'd watch and be like, whatever. But then again, I didn't grow up in, you know, I personally didn't grow up in a small town where there's nothing to do besides, you know, hang out near a slaughterhouse or a farm or whatever.
Mm. Yeah, I'm used to seeing my neighbors get slaughtered. It's the animals. never mind.
Yeah, like, when I told my dad about this movie, he's like, oh, yeah, they'd hang up the pigs and, like, cut them down the middle and, like, stop telling me this. I don't want to hear this.
I mean, it's in the movie It Volume 1, you know, that the whole, they don't even show you these animals being slaughtered, but it's supposed to be horrific, just the idea that, like, this young kid has to grow up on there. That's how detached we are. Like, even a movie's like, this is part of the horror. And they're right for me.
Yeah. All right. So, Tuki Puki is on Cartoon Channel, if you're listening to this and you want to watch it. And you can't really spoil Tuki Puki. And there's a DVD or Blu-ray of the box set, World Cinema, and I think that's it. I'm pretty sure it's like the only releases of it.
Yeah, I mean, it was you couldn't find it for years, so I think that was the first major re-release.
But now we're on to Hyenas, which was this came 19 years later in 1992, played at Cannes. I think won a jury prize or something. I didn't look too much into it. Awards don't really matter to me, It did get acclaim, and he did get attention for it.
I can tell you how this movie opens. There's a bunch of things walking in a field, or not a field, but, you know, but the open area. Animals or something like that, and then followed by a large group of people. And I think they're approaching a bar or a cafe or something. And then it's really weird. The whole thing starts to shake in a single frame. And then your PlayStation tells you it can't read the disc.
Oh.
And it's so crazy that he thought that far in advance to make a movie like that.
I mean, Mbete was a visionary.
That is true. But the plot is pretty simple. It's more plot driven, but to strip it down to its to the bare minimum, it's a woman who was basically discarded by society, and Dakar in, I think it's like 1945, and it's like 30 years later. She's like basically a world class prostitute, and she has millions of dollars. She's a millionaire at this point.
Wow! Yeah. Or even more, since she has more money than the World Bank.
Oh yeah, he does mention the World Bank in a few movies twice. Actually.
Yeah. Wait, is this just something they're saying, or is this reality in the movie?
I think it's reality in the movie, but I do find it interesting. It's like, even if it's like she doesn't have as much money as the World Bank, they have so little money that if she's like a basic like 100,000-aire in America, she probably would have been able to fund that whole town.
Yeah. And so the man, she was having sex with him a whole bunch. She got pregnant, and he's like, "That's not my kid." And she got shunned by the town and left. And she's getting her revenge by being like, well, the town's having some money problems, so if you execute the man who abandoned me, I will give you, I think it's 300,000 francs.
Wow.
Yeah, and so it's about the people turning basically into hyenas and being like, whether or not they're going to keep their morality, among other things. And spoiler alert, pretty quickly, you realize, oh, they're not. They're going to take advantage of this money situation as soon as they can.
Yeah. But also, try to front like they're not doing it. Like, they will constantly be like, oh, no, we're not going to kill you. We're not going to kill you. And then, like, the priest is, like, uncovering his new chandelier. That he has, and Sonny's like, "Yeah, bro, you're in no danger at all." Next to you, by the way, turn on the electricity that we haven't had for the past 10 years, and check that out. It's pretty hilarious, and it makes you think of people who do that, who they're in your face doing one thing, and you're just like, "But that's not what you're doing. You're literally doing something completely different."
Yeah, the dark humor this time really came through. To me, generally, this is a hilarious movie. Cause, knowing.
Aw, man.
Yeah, I think
I wish I got to see it.
Yeah, maybe one day. It might get a Blu-ray release because it's in theaters in certain cities.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, that it was got a remastering and re-release in a couple of the big cities.
Yeah, I went and saw it on Saturday at Metrograph here.
Oh man,
and it was, I have to say, it was it's a really good restoration. Like, sometimes you see these restorations and they're not necessarily the best, or they feel underwhelming, or maybe they did too much and the blood looks like ketchup or something. Mm-hmm. But this was really nicely done. They seemed to really touch it up nicely, but still keep the breath of an older film from that era. It still has the same texture.
That's really cool.
Yeah, I was very pleased.
I think if you're going to do a revival nowadays, like the film geeks among us, we are looking out for that kind of stuff. You totally. Can't just like, oh, it's slightly improved and here it is in the theater. You know, if you're slipping in a 4K Blu-ray into your theater, like, we're going to know.
Yeah.
Because we're dorks and that's what we do.
and we're the ones who are going to go see it. Let's be real.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, honey, let's go see Hyenas. It sounds like an entertaining thing. No, these guys are not going. It's us.
Yeah. And I think this is more accessible than Hyenas. Definitely. I mean, Tukibuki.
It sounds like
it. Is. It definitely is. It's funny. When I went and saw it, I had a couple of friends I had told about it. And they're both film people. But they actually had went and saw it. I didn't know they were going to be there. And they were watching and they were like, oh, wow, it's a lot more straightforward than I thought it was going to be. And I was like, oh, yeah, no, it is pretty. It's a pretty straightforward film.
Yeah, it definitely deals with a lot of like same class and money themes that Tukibuki's dealing with. But it definitely is a more quote unquote normal movie, because I think because he adapted the play by. It's a 50s play.
It's It's a Swiss player, right? Yes. Dormont. I can't say his name right. Friedrich Dormont or something like that.
Yeah, I think that's how you say it. And it was adapted in the 60s with... I forgot what the 60s one was called, but Ingrid... No. The other Bergman. What's her name?
Ingmar?
Yes, the lady Bergman.
Ingrid Bergman, yeah.
Ingrid is the lady. Okay, yeah. Ingmar is the director. Okay.
And she stars in it with...
And there's Freddie Bergman, who works down the street for me, but anyway.
Wait, Joel, you might be able to see in a theater here near-ish L.A.?
I mean, saying that I'm near L.A. is like saying that I could... it's the equivalent of, hey, you live next to the ocean, Joel. Yeah, I know it's there.
Okay.
Like, I mean, this is much more likely than me going to the ocean, because there's fish in the ocean, and there's slightly less fish in Los Angeles, but yeah, I might look for it. Now they know.
Yeah, I just have the crappy Kino DVD, because going to New York just for this would cost too much and not be worth the trip.
I hope it gets some kind of release with this restoration. It would be a shame to just restore it and then just have it sit, you know.
Yeah, the Kino disc is fine, but that's kind of my only option. And I got it a while ago because Kino, I don't know how many DVDs left, but they did a line of African films, and I think it's called like New African Cinema, and they did like maybe 5 or 6. And I kind of snatched those up as soon as I saw them. I'm not sure how much longer those will be around. But they stopped it pretty early.
From what I saw too, it doesn't appear to be a very high quality like conversion. It's like in 4:3.
Yeah. No, and no.
But yeah, I hope that, I mean, they don't have to do anything, but I'm hoping, yeah, the Blu-ray.
I mean, I hope Kino takes over, because they have good track record of it. They did that with the Bill Gunn movie Personal Problems, which is fucking fantastic, which will be a future episode at some point, but I'm not sure when. But so Hyenas, just like the breakdown of people's morality is both on one hand pretty terrifying, just how quickly money can change someone, and also pretty funny, just like how you were saying, people like, oh no, I don't want to, I'm not doing this so you can die. I'm just trying to, you know, buy more fancy stuff. I have electricity now.
Sounds like a Coen Brothers movie.
A little bit, kinda. And it gets into like gets kind of topical, because like into Me Too movement a little bit, with like how she was abandoned by this man and mistreated, and now she's getting her revenge.
Yeah, and Mom Betsy's actually in the movie. He plays a judge and a magistrate, you know, who kind of he oversaw the initial trial where basically the guy lied on her, and now he's, you know, kind of overseeing her affairs of justice now, which I find very interesting that he makes himself that character, especially if you look at the final scene where he watches over them, you know, pretty much, you know, take the man's life. You see Mambete kind of observe the whole thing, and it's definitely him, you know, saying, I'm watching you all who are not being honest. It's definitely him putting him as the watcher, you know, of what's happening in his nation and also the world, I think.
Yeah, I remember I've read some interviews and quotes by him, and he makes a big point of not doing anything specifically like African or Senegalese. He likes to keep things universal.
Totally.
Because like his big thing is the evil of money, and how money ultimately is a bad thing for society.
Yeah.
Because it shows up in Tukibuki of like they're poor, and so they want to escape poverty. This is, the town is poor, and this is like the only way they get money is selling out their morals. And then Lefranc is about a poor man who gets a ticket who gets a lottery ticket that wins, but he has to put stuck to the back of his front door, so he has to carry his front door to the lottery booth in the middle of the city. And then little girl's oldest son is about a little girl who's poor who gets a job because she needs money. It's like money is like the motivator, and I haven't seen his other movies, but like in the ones that are available, money is the main motivator in every case.
Well, I know he was like a big, you know, I guess he was very interested in like third cinema and like third cinema politics. So I could see how, you know, these kind of ideas were very, you know, of money and capital and globalization were very real to him and important to him.
Because like it opens with like them not wanting to use credit. I think that was.
Yeah.
But then once money is involved, like, oh yeah, we can just use credit on this. And this is this whole change, and that reminds me a bit of the autobiography of Malcolm X, where I think it's like it's after his father died, where he's talking about how like you should never use credit because credit will entrap you to the white man and make you serve them for the rest of your life.
I wish I had listened.
You should read the book, Joel. It's a really great book. Okay.
There was a really cool graphic novel version of his autobiography that I've been looking everywhere for, and I think it's just out of print.
I vaguely remember that, actually, now that I think about it. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a big thing when I was working at Barnes & Noble in like the mid-2000s.
Yeah,
like
I kind of remember that.
Like a school assignment type thing.
Yeah.
Oh, also in the book, this back to the animal like slaughter stuff, he mentions his father was so strong he could just twist the head off a chicken.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, like in Babel.
Yeah. Yeah, like how my great grandmother apparently would just like snap their neck like a whip.
I mean, that's it. My own grandfather on my father's side. You know, they had a coop in their backyard in Piru, California. Which, if you know anything about, is not really a town so much as a place where people have ended up, and that's it. he used to do that with in front of my dad. You know, probably my dad even did it himself, as far as I know. You know, just pick up the chicken and kind of like twist them around, till it pop off type of thing. For some reason, we didn't do that in my house. That's weird. So how are these two movies narratively related? Like, do they have characters that fall over?
Well, it's weird because, like...
In theory, they carry over with Anta coming back and, like...
Oh, okay.
But it's not her necessarily, but Mbete in the interview says that the idea kind of came from inserting her into this story of her coming back.
Yeah.
And the person who stays, you know, and who gets to witness what happens to the town. Because that's the thing, like, everyone who's there, it's so impoverished. And you know, he decided to stay and be a part of it, you know. And this kind of, this thinking of this area 20-something years later, what it would look like and as you're entering this.
I see.
Yeah. And there's... kind of going back, and there's like a more symbolism with a bull, where in Tokiboki, Mori is symbolized with the bull, not symbolized. You know what I'm trying to say? Like parallel with the cattle, and hyenas. The guy Dramon Tremet, he is what's the word I'm trying to think of? That they use there's a bull that symbolizes him that gets killed, but you don't see it on camera, but how he dies is kind of strange and surreal, and it ties into how they kill the bull earlier, which is kind of like the real blatant sign of the second time they're like, oh okay, I get what that was now. But where was it? Something about bowls and symbols. God, I think, and you get a watch off. I think this is where you get lots of shots of hyenas.
Yeah.
And you get, I can't remember this one or not that has, like, vultures in the sky.
You yeah, see? there's like, or is it vultures and eagles? I can't remember. It's definitely some, it's birds. But I can't remember what they were now that I remember. I think about it.
Yeah, there's a lot of cutting, comparing humans to animals. Because you know they turn into animals kind of immediately once they get that promise of oh there's money so I can abuse this man because it's okay because everyone will get money, which kind of brings up a complex morale moral crisis of like, well, what would you do in that situation? Honestly, I don't know what I would do if I was in a scenario of you can take money from this person, but that means someone has to die. And it's like, and it's someone that you've known for 20 years. So it's, I have no clue what I would do in that scenario.
Well, the most interesting thing watching it for the second time, and I caught this more this time, was Dramé, the guy who, you know, she wants to, you know, to kill. He's the one who seems to have the most kind of moral. He constantly reminds them that, like, you know, you're doing this because of the money, and he never begs them to keep him alive, but like he reminds them that, like, okay, if you want to do this, but understand you're not doing this for justice. You're not interested in justice.
Yeah.
And I found that very interesting because it makes me think of now. Mm-hmm. Of people who kind of attach themselves to social causes.
Mm-hmm.
And then I go, why are you really interested in this? Are you really interested in abortion rights? Like, really interested? Like, do you really care about police brutality? Or do you care about it because you know that jumping on that bandwagon can get you on the cover of a magazine? And next thing you know, you can catapult yourself to another level of recognition. And it was interesting to think about it within this context. And I think Mambete was very, I think he had his kind of his finger on the pulse of what was going to happen. Because I think he saw that there's a total disingenuousness that people are having about what they're attaching themselves to. Because it's not like if this woman came in there and she had no money, but she told them the truth about what happened, would they have been interested? Probably not.
It's real interesting because, like, it kind of reminds me of Jaws a little bit,
mm-hmm.
where, like, the mayor is kind of playing along. Is like, yeah, kind of how in Jaws the mayor is like, keep the beaches open. It's it's summer season. We need the money. In this movie, the mayor is like, it's all right. We need the money.
Right.
And he wears equally crazy outfits. Which it feels like maybe this is a reference to Jaws, possibly, because I feel like he would have seen like a lot of it. And the whole thing with the bull and how like that society of hunter gatherers that you see a couple times in the movie, how they like surround the bull and the bull dies, and like they surround Drummond. And like he dies, that I'm pretty sure Haroon references this in Grease, the movie he makes that I'm the most meh on it, where like the end it's a similar thing of people surrounding someone to kill them, which I'm pretty sure it's a clear reference, but
yeah,
because he has Mbete's brother do his soundtracks, so. Anyway, hyenas, he directly calls out World Bank, which in the interviews he always brings up is, in his opinion, like one of the biggest evils on the planet. And who was it? It was this money fund that he always talks about.
The International Monetary Fund, or
yeah, I don't know. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, those institutions were so terrorizing to Africa and the developed, I mean, still are, to the developing world, you know. It's you got to think about how bold that is in 92 to just be naming it directly in your film. Like, I'm not even going to beat around the bush. The World Bank. In your face.
Yeah, like, both movies are very angry, but in very different ways.
Yeah.
Like, this is more directly, like, I hate the monetary institutions of the world, and the other one is kind of similar vein, but it's kind of more, a little more localized.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, a little more universal because of, like, being young and stuck in a place. And, like, the whole thing with, like, the animal slaughter on screen, it definitely feels like the work of someone who was particularly angry at that point in time.
Yeah, I kind of going back to Tsukibuki, and I wonder if you ever thought about it, because he constantly, like, would juxtapose the cow slaughtering to, like, you know, the people there. So I was kind of thinking, are you making a direct, you know, reference to the actual people? Are they the cows also? Are they, you know,
that's part of the... That's how I read it.
Yeah, of the herd that's being slaughtered. I didn't think about that the first time for some reason. I don't know why. Today, I mean, not today. This go around, it really hit me kind of hard, actually, thinking about people as, not necessarily as cattle or as, you know, but as yeah, this is something to be consumed and to be destroyed, you know. And eaten, you know, and taken. It really hit me this time.
Yeah, it really taps into the colonialism that still haunts Africa now. Because, like, I listened to BBC Africa podcast, and there's still a lot of dependence on France and Britain in a lot of African countries to this day, because when they're their colonies, they kind of ruined everything.
Yeah, totally.
And some of the problems now are their own fault, but a lot of it is, well, not a lot, but a significant amount of it is definitely just rooted in, well, they were colonies for such a long time, and they were left in not great condition to rule themselves because of blatant racism.
So those movies are pretty good, though, huh?
Yeah, they're both great. But Hyenas is definitely much funnier and easier to
more accessible.
Yeah. One of the funniest parts also of the film is towards the end when they're going to kill him, and I find this very kind of like an overally great touch. They keep saying it's not about the money. It's not about the money. Like, yeah, we're killing you for justice. It's not about the money. And it's really great. It's just he's hammering home the comedy of it, you know. It's he definitely wants you to revel in the absurdity of our modern existence as human beings.
I love that he includes the legal, like, British wigs when they're in court.
Yes.
Which, in a lot of African countries, they still do that. It's a weird carryover from from the colonial era, which is insane, because when those wigs are really heavy, and it gets really hot wearing those wigs. And just seeing it in this movie is like, this is a fucking absurd idea. I don't understand why it happened.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, there, you know, and one other thing I thought was interesting about Hyenas when I watched it, because, you know, I think one thing, and this is where I think my Betsy is really impressive, is, you know, the idea, you know, of Africa being primitive, right? So primitive society, you know, is not equipped. But what's interesting is they become more animalistic the more they're introduced to Western things.
Oh, yeah.
So the idea that is, no, actually the primitive things or the things that are coming to them, they're actually more advanced in all of their advanced ways of deciding things and coming to consensuses as a group have eroded because of these new influential things that have only made human beings into animals, basically. Right, because she says, I want to turn the whole world into a whorehouse, which I found really incredible. Like, that's, you know, and I think it's also clear in the film that, like, her revenge with him is not really that big of a deal. Mm-hmm. She actually even says at the very end of the, when before he goes to die, that she wants him to return to him, like, and so they can spend time together. Like, I don't think she's even that mad at him. She's mad at the society. She thinks the society is shit. So she's like, all right, you know what? I'm going to turn y'all out and show you how much of a whore. You think I'm a whore? Check this out. And it's pretty brilliant. You know, it's a real brilliant assessment. You know, and at the end, you see Mombetse watching them from a hill as they tear the man apart. And it's like, wow. Yeah, bruh. You point the finger.
And the people that kill him are... I don't think you see them use the modern technology at any point because they're presented as like the hunter-gatherers who are like they're still through like the traditionalist. And it's this interesting contrast of like just the technology turned everyone else into animals, but like the justice system that punished him was like a primal,
yeah,
a traditional justice system. Which there's an article you posted on Facebook about hyenas. That's a really great read I read today. That I'll link to it in the show notes. But it's a very comprehensive analysis of hyenas.
Yeah, and it said one thing I never considered, but is totally right that, you know, our modern governments are very, like, these are very recent things. Like, democracy, and as we know it, is actually pretty modern, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, these ways that they go about things are actually very old, and, you know, they have lots of rich tradition, and they've gone through many, you know, periods of development. So it's interesting to think about, as the article really gets into that, you know, these new things that we have here, are they really working? And what are they doing to the traditions that we've, you know, spent tons and tons of time developing?
So
they're not working. Just putting that.
Yeah, I that's a rhetorical question. What are we doing?
Bring it down.
We're destroying ourselves, which is what my Betsy's totally saying. He's not even beating around the bush. He's saying we're killing ourselves. We're gonna die.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a fascinating person. Like I haven't found too much about him, but just it seems like he is an endlessly interesting person to be around and get to know.
Yeah, it's a shame that I feel like there's not more stuff on him out there. Like I would love to like know a lot about him. I bet he did a lot more interesting things that we don't even know about.
Yeah, I wish I could understand and like read Wolof in French so I could actually like do proper research on him and not just have to rely on, hopefully it's translated to English. But that's unfortunately that's not the world we live in. So Joel, so do you want us announce what we're doing this month or next pairing is going to be?
Oh, do I know that?
Yeah.
I know we're doing He Got Game.
Yes, with John Cribbs.
From Spike Lee. Yeah. What is that, 1998?
Yes.
And then the movie that we are pairing that with is One Crazy Summer from... No, I have no idea. What is... what's the pair?
It's not Shakespeare in Love, because I don't want to watch that movie. I have no interest.
What are you talking about? That's such a great...
Sorry.
It will be Eternity in a Day, the Cannes winner from 1998.
Oh, yeah. You told me that, and I totally forgot. You know, I'm really glad we're not going to another soft Oscar throw here. Like, Unforgiven, good movie. I might watch it again a little bit later. Or, you know, down the line. Million Dollar Baby, okay, I've seen it twice. I think I'm done for the rest of my life. If I had to watch Shakespeare in Love, it would just be the sound of me slowly weeping. My gosh.
And after that, we're doing another word pairing of Gunnar and Hess with The Sweet Blood of Jesus. this people like Jesus will have the return of Marcus Penn, and Conjure Hess will have a special guest who will be a mystery until then.
Is it like the Masked Rustler or something like that? That's cool.
Yeah. So I got distracted where Pat's sitting a gecko and a gecko's licking the water off the wall. Okay, I'm sorry. I just noticed the gecko was awake. Sorry.
It's okay. It's totally fine. I understand.
It's cute. So, Ntume, thank you for coming on.
Oh, it's great to be on. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks a lot, sir.
And so, Joel, don't you have a podcast where you talk about Willy Wonka or something?
Oh, no, we just send people into... No, we don't send people to space. Yeah, if you want to hear me and my two co-hosts, Aaron and Sarah, talk about science fiction and fantasy movies, yeah, please don't send me in outer space. You can go to pdsmios.com now, and that'll take you to the Podbean page. And there is a episode list there. We've covered over 150 movies at this point, and it's still going. Most recently, like you said, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, which... It's been talked over many, many times, but I mean, we just have... The entire point of our podcast is to have fun talking about stuff. We're not big analyzers or anything like that. And coming soon, Clash of the Titans, which is my
which pick. One? New or old?
The old.
Oh. The only one. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. I mean. Yes.
Okay, when I heard that, like, maybe Aaron likes a new one. I feel like he would.
He might. You know, I don't know if he's seen it or not. But he's not as picky about his movies as I am. And a random pick we had was Time Walker, which is about a mummy that I'm not going to say anything more about it. That episode will be out by the time this comes out. So, yeah.
And what do I have? Oh, I finally got back to doing reviews on my blog, Jailhouse 701, Japanese Cult Cinema. I was in the middle of moving and kind of got distracted, so I'm back to doing my Sonny Chiba marathon. By the time this comes out, the second part of 4 Sonny Chiba reviews will be out, and the movie is Shogun's Ninja. It's on Netflix, not Netflix, it's on Amazon Prime and other places to watch. Only watch if you love Sonny Chiba. I'll say that. It's just all right. But besides that, I was just on Flixwise Canada talking about my favorite living director, Mohamed Salah Haroun. Talked about Sex Okra and Salted Butter, his French family comedy. Friendly sex comedy thing. It's a comedy. It's a whole lot. And A Screaming Man, which is a very tragic movie that's also very good. And Ntume, do you have anything coming up?
No, I mean, I've been on a few podcasts recently. I was on Champagne Sharks recently and Plan A, discussing various things. And I'm in the depths of getting my first feature film shot, so that's kind of been consuming my life. So hopefully I'll have information on that in the next, 6 months. But other than that, no, I'll be around. Find me on Twitter. I'm around.
All right. And, what else? So, yeah, that's all. See you guys for, Eternity a Day, maybe? I'm not sure when I'm going to release this. So, at some point with the 1998 pairing, it's going to come out. So, see ya, and watch these movies. They are really good.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed.
Thanks for listening.
Nice.
All right, stopping my recording.
And stop.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found at podbean.com, and Spotify, and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell, and thank you for listening.